Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Books Podcast. I'm Sam Leith, the literary editor of Spectator, and this week I'm very pleased to be joined by Caroline Crampton, who's the author of a new book called The Way to the Sea, The Forgotten Histories of the Thames Estuaries. Caroline, welcome. This is a book about the Thames as a whole, not just the estuary, isn't it? But it's also a very personal book. Can you say in what way it's personal, how it comes to be your story as well as the story of the river?
Well, it starts with my parents, who, when they were about the age I am now, so in their early 30s, they'd been born and bred in South Africa, decided that they wanted to get out of there. It was the early 80s. And they built a boat and they sailed it to Britain. They ended up in the Thames estuary coming into London. And at that point, they sort of realised, well, it's a bit late for us to go south now. It's taken months to get here and, you know, we've only just arrived. So they came in through the estuary and they ended up living on the boat for 6 months over the winter in St Catherine's Dock, just by Tower Bridge. Then they kind of thought, well, maybe we don't really want to go back there. Maybe we want to stay here. My dad is a steel engineer and the job he got was at the steelworks on the Isle of Sheppey, way out in the Thames estuary. So that's where they moved to, and that's where they end, and that's sort of where they were living when I was born. So that's how my connection with the estuary began, really. This pure chance that they happened to, you know, decide to come in on the boat through the Thames rather than, you know, the Humber or something.
What did, I mean, it's slightly parenthetical, but what did cause them to think, we'll build a boat and go from South Africa to London? I mean, it's not something everybody does.
Well, it was, yeah. It was, I think, initially, my parents love a project. They always have loved a project. And the projects got progressively larger as they found their feet as a couple, you know, through their 20s and so on. And they'd, you know, done up houses, they'd climbed mountains. And I think they moved from, they were originally from Johannesburg, they moved to Cape Town for work. You know, they lived right by the sea. They had no background in sailing, no family interest, no inherited knowledge of the sea, but they just thought, it's there, let's see what we can do. My dad is an engineer, and my whole life, he's never bought something new when it could be repaired or created from scratch. And I think that's just the kind of people they are.
Good God. Amazing that they got here. I'm sure a lot of people in their position would have founded somewhere in the Atlantic. And
the boat, incidentally, that they built is still going. They sold it when I was about 11 for a bigger, faster, more ocean-going one. But I actually got a message when the book first came out from the person who bought it. It's still going strong down in Devon. It's been across the Atlantic several more times. And yeah.
How extraordinary. That's the book for your parents to write, maybe. What made you, I mean, obviously the estuary was where you were sort of hefted as a child, but the estuary isn't the part of the Thames that most people think about. I mean, one of the points you make at the beginning of the book is it's quite marginal. You know, it's just on the, it's off the right-hand side of the EastEnders opening credits was the
yes,
key, you know, metric for that. So why do you think it has been so occluded? Why is it this sort of terra incognita or whatever?
A few different reasons. I think one of the main ones is just that it's quite an unlovely place superficially. It's very wide and flat and marshy and tidal and, until very recently, very smelly. And I think for that reason, people didn't necessarily choose to spend, you know, if you lived in London and you had time to go away for the weekend or to drive out into the countryside, you wouldn't necessarily go east from the city to do that. You know, there are many, many other compass directions with nicer vistas. And then also just practical stuff like, because it's so wide and flat, you know, they didn't make much sense building major towns there. There aren't important landmarks or sort of, there are big infrastructure things out there, power stations and so on, but not that the general population needs to be aware of. And then I think there's a more psychological effect of, we don't necessarily like to think of what's downstream of us. London in particular on the Thames has this long history of sort of outsourcing the things that it doesn't necessarily want to look at but needs for existence downriver out into the estuary, and you don't necessarily want to go and check on how that's going.
Well, very, very early on, you've got, and you return to it, you have, of course, Joseph Conrad, you know, the great poet of the downriver bit, and saying that, you know, the estuary is what connects, isn't it, to the wider world and all the nasties out there.
Yes, well, I think he very, very astutely made the point that it's the gateway to the rest of the world, both in a very positive sense, in that he was a sailor and, you know, the way to the sea is very much a source of joy for him, but also in the sense that there's a lot of horribleness out there and this is how it's coming in and out.
The form of the book, you've sort of structured it as a walk, haven't you, more or less? Is that fair with putting it?
Yeah.
And why, you know, because you, as your subtitle says, and as you yourself set out, you know, it's the estuary that you're primarily interested in. Mm. Why did you think you needed to go to the head of the Thames to write about it?
Well, I think because that's the part that more people are familiar with, or at least if you think about something you'd like to know about the Thames that you don't already know, where it begins is perhaps where the mind jumps more obviously. Also, I'd just never been there and I was quite curious, so I wanted to see how it all starts. Since I know the ending but not the beginning, I wanted to go back to the beginning. And also, I just think there's something really fascinating about a river like the Thames that has so many different characters all the way through it. And I do think that in order to understand and reprioritise the bit that is the estuary, you sort of have to understand what it was like further up.
Yeah. And what it also sort of runs through your story. I mean, there's a lovely story because you went to university at Oxford, didn't you? And the river was very important to you then, wasn't it, as well?
It was, yes. So I was very ill when I was at Oxford. I like to think of it, I was doing a degree, but I was also doing chemotherapy at the same time as sort of dual curriculum type thing.
Joint honours.
Yeah. And as a result, I didn't really tell very many people there that that's what I was doing. You know, obviously, the people in authority knew, but apart from a few very close friends, everyone just thought I was, you know, doing what all the other students were doing. Sometimes that kind of got a bit much, and I used to just disappear for a day and walk up and down the Thames, or the Isis, as it's called, within the confines of Oxford, just as a way of, you know, not having to constantly check myself about who I said what to and who I was being at that particular moment.
You're a literature student at Oxford. This is a book that's absolutely saturated with the literature of the Thames. It's been one of the great pleasures of it, for me at least. Was this something that you'd kind of always been really into, or did you sort of go looking in order to write this book? I mean, you know.
Well, I hadn't really thought about that before, but I think I had been subconsciously just gravitating towards those things. So, like, I'd read all of Conrad long before I read his essay collection about his time at sea, where he writes about the estuary, and just really liked it because I liked the way he writes and I like his sort of generally seagoing personality. But then I read The Mirror of the Sea, which is his autobiographical essay collection that has quite a lot in it about the estuary, and I thought it sort of clicked. So I think I don't think I really read anything new for the book. It was already there, but doing the book connected it in a way that it hadn't been before.
And were you conscious, I mean, are there influences on how you did the book itself? I mean, in some ways, people like Ian Sinclair and Robert McFarlane seem to come to mind as sort of antecedents. I mean, did you sort of look consciously to the ways of doing psychogeography or whatever you want to call it that people have done before? Or, I mean, are those people you admire? Or
I admire their writing very much. I tried not to look too hard, just because it is a very popular practice now, that what you might glibly call going for a walk and having feelings about it.
So I tried
not to sort of get too steeped in that, so as not to be too consciously imitating, and rather just go and see what happened, as it were. I think I was quite lucky in the sense that, well, I also tried to be very honest at all times, because I do think sometimes that kind of writing can feel a bit too pat. It just seems so coincidentally perfect that a sunset sort of rose just at the moment when you were feeling like the endings were drawing nigh. So I tried to just sort of tell it as it happened, you know.
Just admit when you can't get
can't get through to the water, or when you get a bit lost, or when things aren't quite how you thought they were going to be.
What surprised you most in researching the book? I mean, because there's quite a lot of, well, certainly a lot in here that surprised me, of sort of forgotten history or things that, you know, I hadn't known or hadn't even known I hadn't known. Were there one or two things that you actually went, right, you know, I never knew this?
Yeah, and specifically both of them actually are shipwrecks, where in both cases the loss of life was just so enormous that I couldn't believe that it just hadn't come up in, I did history all the way through school, and yet this had never come up. In one case, so the Princess Alice disaster, which happened off Woolwich, in sort of 1878, I think, where a pleasure steamer returning from Gravesend with about 900 people on it hit a coal ship just off Woolwich, and the steamer broke in half and went down in a few minutes. And coincidentally, it happened right at the moment when the big pumping stations that Joseph Bazalgette's great sewers that cleaned up London, he was actually just sort of piping the stuff further downriver and then releasing it into the river. And they'd released it into the river right at the moment when the steamer went down. And so about 800 people sort of drowned in raw sewage in a really horrific, horrible way, which just seemed...
Presumably the survivors immediately got cholera.
No, yeah, no. Some people died sort of four or five, they were rescued from the water and then died 4 or 5 days later. And awful stuff, like some of the corpses they recovered swelled so big they had to make specially large coffins. And, you know, it was just the stuff of nightmares. And I'd never even heard of this. I found this little sort of memorial information board in a bush by the riverbank on the south side. And that was the first I'd come across.
Gosh, you described coming across that. And I was thinking, is that all? And is that, yeah, you know, you just stumbled on that?
I mean, if you, I then, you know, went and looked in newspaper archives and stuff. And at the time, it was an enormous deal. You know, the Times in particular ran weeks and weeks of coverage of it, you know, survivors' testimonies and calling for public inquiries. And, you know, it was really a big political scandal that this sewage pumping had been going on. But it didn't percolate through to the history books somehow. And then the other thing was in the Medway, actually, the sinking of HMS Bulwark during the First World War, which was just a sort of, I say just, but a kind of straightforward military disaster, in that a ship carrying a lot of explosives blew up and everyone apart from about a dozen people who were blown completely clear in the initial explosion died. And there's actually a very moving little ceremony that the mayor of Rochester, in his ceremonial role as, I think it's called Admiral of the Medway Fleet or something, they in procession, they come down the river and they throw a wreath into the water where it happened and they have a little service and so on. But again, you know, I grew up sailing on the Medway and I guess I just happened to never witness the ceremony and therefore didn't know it happened.
Isn't there also famously a wreck that's absolutely packed with explosives, yes, somewhere out there as well?
Yeah, so just sort of in the murky bit where the Medway comes out and joins the Thames and no one's quite sure what it is, which river is which, it's called the SS Montgomery. And it was an American ship, that supply ship, that came across Atlantic in 1944 with, I think there were supplies for D-Day, you know, ammunition specifically. And they were anchored, the anchor dragged, the ship hit a sandbank and broke in half and went down. But half of it's still on the sandbank, so at low tide you can still see the masts because it's really not that far down. And all the ammunition is still on there. The government surveys and stuff say it's probably still alive.
But nobody really wants to go and get it.
Well, I think the sort of scientific judgment is that trying to make it safe would, that an explosion would be more likely than if you just sort of leave it. There was a...
There's a caper movie waiting to be written, isn't it?
Well, different situation, but there was a Polish ship, similarly very explosive, that was wrecked in the Channel, I think off Folkestone, and they did try and, you know, make it safe and cause an explosion that blew all the glass out of all the windows in the town. So I think, and that was sort of way back in the 60s or something. So I think after that, they kind of thought, we'll just let well alone. Patrol it. It's all very carefully marked with buoys so that people can't get near. Although I don't know so much anymore, but it used to be a bit of a thing among people who lived on the Isle of Sheppey to get your picture taken touching it. People would paddle out in canoes and so on. Obviously, very illegal and not allowed.
No, not good with the old health and safety. Mm-mm. You go right back in time as well. I mean, I was interested in the way you talk about how important the river's been, I mean, in terms of the consolidation of kind of power, especially. I mean, you paint a picture of it as being essentially kind of bookended at one point by Windsor Castle and the Tower of London.
Yes.
How's that affected the way the river was seen over the years? I mean, is it...
I think until recently it was at least partially always thought of as a potential route of invasion. And so over centuries there have been, you know, the Vikings came in that way, the Danes, the Dutch during the sort of 16th, 17th century came in and burned the fleet at Chatham. You know, so there's always that hesitation. So the idea of having fortresses on the Thames or defences goes back a long time. But even, you know, before he
went and famously died in Khartoum, General Gordon was in charge of Cliff Fort on the Hu Peninsula, you know, important naval position to defend the Thames. That was in the 19th century, you know. So it's always been this sort of slightly fraught battleground in terms of, you know, it enables this incredible openness with the rest of the world. You know, we can export, we can import, but also baddies might come in this way.
Nicely put. To move to goodies, Bazalgette, who you've mentioned once or twice already, he seems to be one of the kind of heroes of this story, or sort of major characters, for two reasons, isn't it? There's the embankment and obviously the fact the Thames ceased to be a giant open sewer full of shit. How did he transform London? I mean, how important is he to the story of the Thames?
He's absolutely vital. You know, everyone's heard of probably the great stink of London, when everything got so disgusting that Disraeli could no longer countenance holding parliamentary committees in the Palace of Westminster. But things had been building for a couple of decades towards that, when, you know, the population of London absolutely exploded, no real sanitation system properly existed. The two things were obviously, you know, going to coincide. And what sewers they were, incidentally, weren't even meant for refuse or anything. They were meant to just drain off flood water. So they all led to the river, because that's where you'd want your flood water to go. So that's how the river ended up a kind of open sewer. And then when...
There's a lovely cameo for Faraday in this, isn't there?
There is, yeah. Well, he was very instrumental as well. He did this scientific experiment where he took a steamer upriver, dropping little white cards at stated distances, and he measured how long it took for the card to sink before he couldn't see it anymore. And it was, you know, matter of fractions of seconds. He then, you know, published this finding saying, you know, the Thames is so disgusting that you can't even see white paper that's floating just under its surface. All these little things kind of galvanised. Eventually Disraeli got the political will together and got the money. It was an awful lot of money. Bazalgette already had a plan in place. You know, he'd drawn up this idea for intercepting sewers along either side of the river, encased in concrete embankments, taking, so all the sewers of the city would come into these big, and then that would take it east, and then these pumping stations would release it into the river at high tide, past the important bits of the city.
Okay, so into the estuary.
Into the estuary, and then the high tide would take it out. And what's interesting is, so after the Princess Alice sort of showed that that wasn't necessarily the greatest idea, an improvement, but not
far enough away yet,
a total solution, they then started loading it into what were nicknamed Bovril boats, for obvious reasons. These ships that essentially floating tankers that then took it even further out into the estuary, into a brilliantly named part called Black Deep, and released it there, dispersed it down into the water. They were still doing that until the early 90s, 1990s. God. And then EU legislation made that very illegal.
Well, we'll be able to do it again soon.
Yeah,
it's great. sovereignty.
In a nice little touch, I think the first Bovril boat was called Bazalgette.
Was it? That's nice. Actually, though, you do, and maybe that's part of it, you describe, even within your own memory, the waters of the Thames vastly improving. Mm. I mean, you say in this sort of rather nostalgic way, you know, the smell's changed.
It really, well, the smell's disappeared. That was why we didn't have a smell, where it used to have a smell. You know, so my early memories of the Thames are sort of from the late 80s, early 90s, fast forward sort of 25-ish years. And, you know, a lot of industry has disappeared in the Thames, so because that was a lot of the pollution was actually industrial rather than domestic. That's just naturally disappeared. Someone I heard once this amazing fact that there was an awful lot of silver in the Thames from photographic development, the runoff from, and of course now there's very little of that, everything's digital, so that's naturally, that source of pollution's naturally disappeared. But then also, obviously, you know, we've got better at being environmentally conscious and not just dumping things. Landfill sites have become lovely parks and all that kind of thing.
And you've got a lovely moment where you glimpse a sea otter and practically collapse.
Yeah, a seal. Yeah, sorry. Never seen a seal before in the Thames. I was completely astonished. But even there are loads of RSPB reserves now in the Thames estuary that they didn't used to be there. So there's just a sense that people are a little bit more conscious that it's a place worth preserving and taking care of.
But this theme of things, you know, as Bazalgettes take Bovril boats and everything else, you know, you take the push down river, anything you don't want. And that seems to be a theme of the book. I mean, when you're talking about the redevelopment of St. Catherine's Docks, what I was surprised to see was that there's a sort of precedent to that. It's not just, oh, it's Thatcherite redevelopment in the 80s and 90s where, you know, yuppies take over St Catherine's docks and the local residents are all sort of pushed further out down the estuary. But the initial redevelopment, they were trying to knock down children's hospitals at the end of the, you know, 18th century, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, they did successfully, and I'm still angry about this when I found out about this, that miraculously these buildings, the Priory of St Catherine's, which was this medieval hospital, survived the Great Fire of London, one of the very few medieval buildings in the sort of heart of the City of London to do so. And they knocked it down to build a dock, which is astonishing. So yes, early 19th century, those incredible historic buildings plus, you know, homes for about 11,000 people, all knocked down to build St Catherine's Dock.
And as you describe it, it's those, that was a sort of tipping point, wasn't it, at the end of the 18th century, when, because what we think of as these sort of ancient docks that, you know, come off the Thames and are little kind of enclosed waterways into which boats can go. It wasn't like that before, was it?
No, they were a new innovation in the early 19th century. And up until then, the Corporation of the City of London had a complete legislative monopoly over the right to unload ships in the Thames. And so they had wharves mostly round the custom house. You know, that had been the way for centuries. It was, I think, Elizabethan legislation that confirmed that monopoly. And then it was actually particularly the coal ships coming from the northeast that really tipped things over the edge when London suddenly exploded and became this, you know, huge industrial city at the beginning of the 19th century. It needed so much coal, and the coal ships arrived on every tide, and there wasn't enough space to unload them. Plus, you've got West India merchants starting to arrive and all that kind of thing. There just wasn't enough space, so ships were having to moor in the centre of the river, waiting for a wharf to be free, and a kind of crime spree emerged, where a whole new generation of waterborne thieves popped up and started pinching stuff. Unsurprisingly, the businessmen who were losing an awful lot of money that way eventually managed to persuade Parliament that they had to stand up to the City of London and do something about that. And the legislation that allowed the creation of enclosed docks into the riverbank was the result.
So it's kind of, in some ways, a great leap forward for the free market, unless you're a children's hospital.
Unless you're a children's hospital or someone who happened to live where they wanted to build a dock. I did some research in the parliamentary archives about that, because it did require, each new dock required a new act of Parliament for it to be built. And as part of the case for why this act should pass, or this bill should pass, the people who wanted to build it went door to door in the precinct of St Catherine's and tried to do a survey and asked everybody what they thought. And there's this handwritten hundreds of pages of names and yes, no, or decline to answer, and sort of ticks. And of course, everyone said no or decline to answer. Of course, I don't want you to build a dock in my house. But they asked and they submitted it as part of the evidence
and
for the bill anyway.
It.
And then it passed and they got what they wanted.
Well, it's again wonderful sort of precedent when we've seen it happen again and again. Now, another of the stories that you bring up, which, you know, you said, you know, we all know about the Great Stink, but not about these catastrophes. You know, we all know about the Great Storm of 87, but I think very few of us know about the giant flood of the 1953. Which is why we've got the Thames Barrier, which I had no idea about. Tell us about flooding.
Well, 1953 was by no means the biggest or what was, I think, the most drastic. But the Thames had been flooding for centuries. There are all these, Daniel Defoe wrote a whole book about one in the 18th century called The Great Storm. Every storm is the great storm until the next great storm. But there are all these nice little tidbits I found in these sort of 19th century history books of reports of lawyers from the sort of 13th and 14th century saying, well, yes, the flood receded and there were fish left on the floor of Westminster Hall. It just had been happening forever. And every time was the worst time in living memory. And it just didn't happen quite often enough for anyone to do anything about it. And of course, as centuries passed, you know, the great sort of shipping enterprise and the port that was London, far too economically important to consider altering the geography of a river in a way that might protect inhabitants from flooding. So that's why it kept happening.
And then, so they became the necessary collateral damage.
So then 1953, it was this sort of horrible confluence of really, really heavy rain, so very swollen river coming down, a sort of depression out in the North Sea that pushed the water up, and then a very high spring tide coming in. So all the things that could go wrong did go wrong, essentially, and this great wall of water came down the North Sea. And the Dutch coast suffered very heavily as well. But all down Lincolnshire, Norfolk, Suffolk, Essex, and then into London, about 300 people died in Britain in one night. And awfully, because it happened, you know, in the winter, people who survived the rising floodwaters, who managed to get onto the roofs of their houses and stuff, then died of the cold while they were waiting to be rescued.
God. And so the Thames Barrier was built, only 20 or 30 years later.
Yeah, again, but this is what's so amazing about it, is that I think we can probably relate in our current political situation that after it happened, something must be done. But what was the general feeling? Because, you know, the docks, I mean, St Catherine's Dock didn't close until 1968 to trade. The docks in Inner London were still, you know, doing millions of pounds worth of business. So they, the operators, were, well, of course you're not putting some kind of permanent barrier across the river that would mean our ships couldn't get in. Absolutely not. And so it was a political wrangle as well as a sort of engineering problem to be solved. And eventually what they came up with is what we have now as the Thames Barrier. But interestingly, I think it's not just the barrier. The whole modern system of how flood prevention works came from that. So just the idea that you need connected reporting so that when something bad is spotted out to sea, everybody finds out at the same time, rather than what happened on that night, which was almost, it made me think of the old-fashioned system of lighting a beacon when you see an invader coming. That was the level of how they could pass on the information to the people upriver. So every community and every police force and stuff, there's an amazing book about it called The Great Tide by an Essex County librarian called Hilda Grieve. She compiled this huge volume of testimony about what happened. They all found out fresh. They had no prior warning. So every local bobby was going, what? You say there's a flood?
And then he turned around and be up to his knees in water. God. Do you think there is or was ever a kind of golden age of the Thames Estuary or the areas that you're most interested in? I mean, do you look back and think, God, it was wonderful when it had that desolate, spooky wasteland vibe about it? Or, you know, God, I hate those glass towers and Canary Wharf. And, you know, or do you think you treasure it just for being a palimpsest?
I think the latter. I mean, I have conflicting feelings about a lot of the things on there. Even you mentioned the smell. I kind of miss the smell, even though I recognise it's a very good thing.
Yes, you
say
it in a slightly embarrassed way. You know, this was, you know, your kind of Madeleine was that kind of slightly crappy, exotic, sort of pooey smell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, but it's true. And so I also write a bit in the book about there were two important power station chimneys in the estuary that were, when my father was teaching me to navigate, to steer the channel without having to look at the chart, these two cooling towers on the Hoo Peninsula on the Isle of Grain were very important in the system that he taught me. And now they're gone. They've been demolished because they were, you know, nasty, polluting, dirty coal and gas power stations, and now we have much cleaner wind power. But they're gone, and I miss them.
Oh, I'm quite right, too. And if you steer into a wreck full of explosives by accident, would be the fault of the people who knocked down those chimneys. You're a very boaty baby, aren't you? I mean, you describe teenage years spent not, you know, plugged into a SNES or Xbox or whatever, but sitting, trying to pass the time. But you say you get seasick as well.
I get horribly seasick, but so does my father. And, you know, he's sailed from Cape Town to Falmouth and from Falmouth to Boston. And, you know, he's sailed all over the world. And but I suppose having a father who was that seasick and yet such a great sailor and so determined taught me that you just throw up over the side and you carry on.
And do you still, I mean, are you one of those people who feels most at home on a boat?
Not most at home, but definitely very at home, I think. It was strange when, because my parents were huge helps in writing this book, and they brought their new boat, although it's not that new, they've had it for 15 years, but in my mind it's the new boat. They brought it up to Tower Bridge so that we could sort of recreate a journey back out to sea, which is then in the book. And I was astonished at the muscle memory that still remained. You know, I haven't sailed with them for years, and yet I still have the exact sort of wrist flick to get the rope off the bollard and just know when to duck the head and all of that kind of thing, which I didn't know that I knew, but it's all still in there somewhere.
Yes, and also they lent you, which is very touching. Is it the logbook?
The logbook.
This sort of sacred thing that instead of having a family album, you've got this set of
charts. Yes.
Well, so we've got the set of charts, which were the original charts that my parents bought before they... Because they, when they came from South Africa, they sort of made their first landfall at Falmouth. And then they came along the south coast. And they stopped, I think, at Brighton to buy some charts so they would actually know what it was that they were going to get into, having never been there before. And so, yes, the original charts...
Can you just sort of stop in Brighton? I mean, you just rock your boat up to a pier and...
There's a marina. You can, yeah. Yeah, so they got some charts. And then before they left South Africa, I can't remember who, but someone gave them this gift of this really beautiful logbook. It's huge and it's got a big leather spine. It's all filled now. They're onto volume 2 or 3. But, and my father got into the habit of keeping a proper nautical log, you know, with all of the weather conditions and the boat speed and all that kind of thing. And even as a child, I didn't understand why he was so boring. You know, he just used to write stuff like, you know, beat northeast 4 hours going good, and I would say, but Dan, you know, we had hot dogs, it was great, you didn't put that in there. And he said, well, it's for the boat, this is the boat's book, this is not our book. But you can, if you read it, you read between the lines, you can, even though I'm not mentioned, the type of sailing they're doing changes once I'm born, so I am there in a way. And yeah, so they filled up this whole book and several others since with all of their doings.
Wonderful. Well, you've added to the family log books anyway with this. Caroline Crampton, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. And if you did, we very much hope that you'll subscribe on your podcast provider of choice and or rate and review us. Well, especially if you liked it. If you hated it, don't feel you have to review it. And equally, if there's something that you wanted to ask us about, something you think we could do better or something you enjoyed, please do send us your feedback to podcast@spectator.co.uk. Thanks again for listening, and please join us for our next episode.